to rely on international tuition as a way to fund our public sector, which is obviously unfortunate. And that reliance will have to stop. So that will mean we will need a new funding model that works, that is not just, drawn out of thin air, but actually is focused on what the needs of the province are. And that will mean that we have to rely more on domestic students and what domestic students need here to be able to attract them, to be able to get them into the workforce. It's a much larger conversation, but I think those conversations are happening.
And I think that we touched a little bit on the question on what is the strategy right now that universities are taking to handle the drop in international enrollments. But can you try to go a little bit of the larger problems that it's causing, not only SFU, but to all universities trying to handle this new budget and this new diversifying strategy?
So the draw for international students used to be that there was this possibility of PR. It was sold to international students, like you come do education with us, and then you'll get a PR, and then you will have a pathway to permanent residency and citizenship eventually if you're contributing. And that was the narrative for like the last 10 years. That draw has gone now. International education is very expensive. It's still cheaper than America, but it's nowhere close to Germany where you get free education as an international student. So the differences are very apparent now. Students are realizing that there's a much broader world. Canada is not as welcoming anymore. So the draw for Canada has gone from the talent pipeline. So it's very difficult for both sides meaning the new incoming workers. We saw Canada as a destination where you could find meaningful employment, and the other side who saw Canada, the employers, the businesses who saw Canada as a place for building businesses that would have a sure shot talent pipeline. That disconnect has just gotten much wider, and the role has become that much more difficult. So what I've seen universities are doing. Are they're pivoting on what has worked, so what's been tried and tested. So research universities are really focusing on applied research, like, okay, we have this wonderful depth of research coming out of our institutions. How are we going to apply it, turn it into innovation hubs, and really capitalize on those? And the institutions that are more focused on domestic needs, like BCIT, they're focused on, okay, how do we get people into these roles ASAP. So how do we get people employed? So people are pivoting. Regional universities are focusing on what their regions need. So everybody's really focused on, okay, how do we be more agile? Where do we address these needs? And some people are doing much better than others. Like some institutions are that much more adaptable. But it is definitely a conversation because our province is so varied. It means the institutions have to respond in a varied way, and that gives everybody a chance to do something or the other.
Yes, no, that's true. And I'm trying here to get a little bit of the conversation on where you're heading, but this is directly tied to how heavily, as you said, all universities, not SFU, but both universities rely on international tuition. For example, I know that there's a name, for example, for us to go for at least 50% of the budget being funded by provincial or federal governments, but we actually see like right now it dropped it to 38% around. So we know that there is a heavy cost that comes from enrollment and not necessarily just funding as some public universities in other countries do. So just looking at that, do you think that reliance on this type of funding is sustainable or even ethical? Like thinking about students who are facing cuts to services?
Absolutely not, because right now the status of international students in Canada, or at least for the last decade, they've been portrayed as these cash cows, that international students have money, which is why they're able to come here, which is not the reality. A lot of the international students who did come here, who were exploited and are more likely to be exploited by bad actors within the system, happen to be people who've taken out massive loans to come here to this country to study. Like, I don't know about most other countries, but I know within India, the consensus was, okay, we're gonna send our kid off. We're gonna take whatever loans we can get. We're gonna mortgage all our property, all our land, all our shops, and we're gonna send our kid there so that they can have a better life for themselves, so that they can build something out of their own lives. And they were sold this false promise of what the actual ground reality was. Like, nobody was told about the reality of the high housing costs, the high cost of healthcare, the high food costs. And these systems were just not built up. So the ethicality, yes, you can charge that much if you're offering something. And I think it becomes unethical when you're selling somebody a false promise. Because there will still be students who will come here. There are still wars in the world. People are still fleeing, like wars in Afghanistan. Like, that is still happening. Canada is still a great place for them. It is still a safe haven. They will still be making their lives. But for somebody in India who is mortgaging all of their property, I don't know if that is selling that dream to them ethical. So that's where my binaries are a little, like, the line gets gray.
Oh, and that makes a lot of sense. It's still, as you were saying, like a country that's supposed to receive people, but the motto is not adequate anymore, right? And talking about the motto, like as we were highlighting, it affects differently principles of accessibility, but also thinking about the general equity and the accessibility, both for international students and broader campus community. How is this being affected? What are the highlights on this?
The international student caps.
Just directly addressing like the models of equity and accessibility. For example, what is on my mind asking this question is, for example, asking about food security.
Absolutely. So the biggest impact is when you're over relying on international tuition. Any shock to international tuition is that much more impactful versus a shock to domestic tuition. So if an international student enrollment goes down by 300, you will lose just as much money. And this is okay. So I'll give you an example of, I think, either Okanagan College or Selkirk College or something over there, where they lost 300 students, and the impact was $2 million. This is 300 international students, versus when they lost 900 students domestic, the impact was 1.98. So it was still below the loss of that. So that's what I'm trying to say. Like, the impacts are that much more magnified. And there are colleges right now where they have only four international students in their whole institution, because they just haven't been able to attract or retain. And that happens. Like, that is the reality right now. And these institutions heavily rely on international students to be able to support their communities. Like, there are institutions that are anchor institutions. So the impact of international tuition is outsized, no matter what scale you're at. SFU happens to be not UBC, but it's still pretty high up there. And even SFU is struggling. Like you mentioned, food security, but food security is not the only place. Cal hasn't seen, I'm sp talking specifically for Center for Accessible Learning at SFU. Their need was supposed to be for at least doubling of staffing. They were serving 500 students, and now they're serving 1,500 students, and that probably is going to be more. Like, when you're talking about accessibility, you're talking about how the whole institution needs to take that responsibility. It should not be just one department. But we don't have the funding to be able to train the whole institution to uplift themselves and better themselves. And these funding gaps get, like, things fall off the table, and accessibility and equity happens to be one of those things. Like, we're saying we're focused on First Nations reconciliation. Those things tend to fall off. Like, so you really have to make that commitment to be like, yes, this is a priority. Food security is a priority. Healthcare is a priority. Health and counseling services, like, you're booking 4 weeks into advance, like 4 weeks into, or 3 weeks into when you want to see the doctor, for a non-urgent appointment. Like that is insane to me, where you're waiting 4 weeks to see a doctor when back home I could just walk in and see a doctor. And it cost me $2 to get like a diagnosis, right? Like, or a diagnostic, whatever, appointment. And this is my parents laugh at me. Like, where are you? Like, is this a third world country? Are you sure you're in? And those are the sort of conversations we need to be having, where like these are the services that universities are providing because the province has not been able to keep up. And they've had to take up the mantle. And when you're telling them, yes, you're getting all of these students, you have a responsibility, and then you're taking the funding away and you're saying, no, you still have to fill this gap of services that we haven't been able to fill, that the province or the country hasn't been able to fill. That falls off for everybody. So now you're underfunded on two ends. So the people suffering are people who are usually having the least amount of access, no matter where they go.
And also reveals a problematic issue that comes from the province and their general strategy welcoming immigrants as well, right? Focus on mostly as a funding option, that rather trying to focus on the markets as it was supposed to be in the beginning.
This might get taken as an attack on one provincial party or the other. I will say this was not one provincial party. This has been successive parties. Back in the 1980s, we used to be 80% publicly funded, our public institutions. And over the years, now it's gone to, like you said, around 40%. So this is not one political party saying. One political party saying this is an issue, this is how we're going to solve it. This has been successive political parties, and it's been years and years of underfunding, where the conversation has come to we need to get rid of domestic tuition caps for the universities to be able to catch up and meet their spending costs. I don't that's where we're heading. We're losing fights left, right, and center. And it's just not a diss on one political party or the other. It's just we all need to come together and advocate for this. Like, this is not the direction we want to be because we've been in this direction for a while and it's not working anymore.
Yeah, even if it was the matter of one that took the decision, it's the problem of others that continue the job, right? Just maybe shifting a little bit from the general context on student advocacy, just because you were recently part of Spring Advocacy Week in Victoria, right? How did the government respond to those concerns about tuition funding and the long-term consequences of all this?
They were very surprised. They did not know the magnitude of challenges. There was a lot of conversation around the first things first. They were very surprised. They were very receptive. People understood the impact of public institutions, especially in communities where like these institutions solve basically they're the major source of employment in wherever community they're in. People understood that these institutions have a huge role to play within economies. They're sort of the lifeblood of the communities where they are. And that was obviously amazing to like see. We had the Minister for Jobs, the Minister for Skilled Trades, all saying, yes, this is something that we want to focus on. We don't want to give up on our wins that we've previously had. The 2% domestic tuition cap needs to be maintained for everybody. We have to come up on ways to stop not just the fees, but also ancillary fees within the 2% cap. Universities are trying to skirt it. So there was a lot of good that came up. A lot of the pushback was, oh, there's admin bloat, and admin bloat needs to go away. And I think, at least at SFU, we've seen they've had a very sustained focus on we don't cut frontline staff, we keep all the positions that are externally funded, we make sure that we're when we're like consolidating things, we're making it to be the most impactful across services. So like we're not taking services away, we're not having one communication department, like communication department in every single department, but we're having communication be centralized. so that way we can send the message out faster. So they're being thoughtful about it. They're like, okay, first level of student-facing services don't need to go. Teachers don't need to go. We're going to keep our teachers. And I think that was a very mindful way of going about it. But that still means we are losing services such as the things that made us part of the community, that made us the lifeblood, that like sort of did impact. So food security, like you mentioned, student societies had to take over the food pantry, but SFU has been very supportive of it throughout the whole time. They've put some money aside for us. They've given us the space to be able to take on that service. So it's like a bittersweet thing, but we don't want to be taking that on. With terms of the external department completely left for SFU, which meant all of the community services that we were doing. I think it's called the VOCE, Vancouver Office of Community Engagement. That was completely gutted. And those are just some examples of like how we're seeing these sort of things play out. I completely lost for the original question.
It's okay. We were just trying to target a little bit more on what happened on the spring weekend, how the people were, how the parliamentarians were receiving the advocacy from you.
Yeah, so they think it's an admin bloat issue, whereas I was trying to say no, it's a funding issue. And there was also some other people across the aisle who mentioned the role private institutions have to play. They're saying healthcare should not be blocked. Like private institutions do have a role to play. And I had to say, look, we've seen how public-private partnerships have gone. FIC, we know the quality of education they're getting. It's great, but it's not SFU, and I've heard it from FIC students. So you can say all of these things. You can say like the level of quality in private institutions the same, but no, their motive itself is not the same. Our education is a public good. It should remain publicly funded. And you can't say it's a public service and then go ahead and take a wrench to it and just like, or take an axe to it and cut it all and gut it out completely. So if it's a public good, it has to be publicly funded and it has to be a public priority. And I think that was not something that was understood by everybody. And that's why we need to come together and really advocate and make some noise about this, because I don't think we're making enough noise.
That makes a lot of sense. And that comes in hand with some campaigning that is trying to be organized provincially, right? I can even give room to talk a little bit about that if you feel comfortable. But if not, I was also trying to aim a little bit more on what directly you heard from students about the situation and what you had the opportunity to directly say to David Ebai.
Oh yeah, so I wasn't in the room when David Eby was there, but I've seen him on multiple instances, and I've always told him we need to fund our public institutions more. He's a busy guy. He's always running around. He was like, "Yep, set something up for me." I have his chief of staff number, but when you think about it, like for him, he just hasn't heard enough. And with the conversations around tariff, when you think about it, like the way things are going in the States, like the Scott Bessent guy, he's like apparently the only voice of reason. Trump is just doing whatever the fuck he wants. Pardon. And that basically comes to a point where people are really focused on, listen, we're going to be underfunded. Public education is a burden. Like it's a service that we have to fund. We can only fund it if we have money to fund it. And the money to fund it comes from businesses who are generating employment, right? So we have to tie it back full circle to be able to say, you can only fund businesses who would want to come here if you're funding the talent pipeline to be able to go back into those businesses. Otherwise, those businesses are going to leave, tariffs or no tariffs. So the focus has been so much on the tariff conversation that people are forgetting that the whole reason we have Canada where we are right now is because of our public education system. And a lot of the people that we spoke to across both sides of the aisle really look fondly about the public education system and why that is the reason why they are where they are. So we have to remind people that no, the public education system is a priority. Students want this to be a priority. And we've just been trying to get that message across every time we see him.
Just before moving into the general conversation on how to solve this, which it comes a lot to our both of our personal opinions too, do you have any comments on the what are the campaigns being organized right now? What needs to be like, what do we need more from those?
So we've spoken a bit about the asks that we had when we went to Victoria. So when we went to Victoria, we were representing over 300,000 students along with BCFS, which is the BC Federation of Students. They represent a lot of smaller colleges, especially within the rural BC. And we had UVic and we had SFU. SFU itself is like 25,000 undergraduate students. UVic itself is like 20,000, around 20,000 undergraduate students. So when you get to that level of scale, you're talking about, okay, what are the biggest priorities? So one of the ones was, let's not give up the win that we already have, because we've heard rumors from universities, not SFU apparently, but other universities have let their students know that we're actively lobbying to get rid of the 2% cap. And that's problematic for students. So students have to come together and lobby. So one of the asks was, hey, can you reaffirm that the 2% cap will be maintained? We've heard a lot about it. This is concerning. Can you reaffirm that it will be maintained? And that was well received, so we were happy about that. The second one was, we need to fund post-secondary more. And that's where a lot of the hesitation came. So we were like, okay, and even if you're not giving us more funding, let's start with an analysis of the problem. So let's do a review of the post-secondary funding model. Right now, it's very arbitrary. Universities have to meet a certain number of student enrollments to be able to get this much funding, and then they get more funding, or they don't get more funding if they go over that number, but they have to meet that number. Where are these numbers coming from? We don't know. So it's a little all hand wavy right now. Doesn't look too good from the comments that were made. We're still waiting on the post-secondary minister to provide that. And then there's also other challenges that are coming up, especially in terms of BCP&P numbers being cut down. So the province just not having enough leeway to actually do things with their BCP&P program, because they just don't have enough seats to give away. So they're really focused on what the province needs, which is healthcare, construction, and early childcare, to be able to prioritize their $10 a day mandate. And then healthcare, because they want to give everybody a doctor, construction, because they want more housing. So they're really focused on their priorities. And right now, education doesn't fit in anywhere. International students don't fit in anywhere. So the pathway for international students to stay here is only getting smaller and smaller. So it's just getting that much more difficult to be able to attract international students to keep funding the way things are currently funded. So the problem is only going to get worse.
And that makes a lot of sense with the problem itself, right? If it's not a general focus, it's we need more lobbying and we need all these student
Absolutely.
organizations to come together even more
Absolutely.
than what's happening right now.
And in backroom conversations off the record, that's exactly what we were told. Some of them told us, back in my time, students gave us a lot of pressure, and right now there's none. And even some other people, they're like, our hands are tied. Students are not doing enough. We need more noise. We need more advocacy. We need more media. The post-secondary ministry keeps track of whatever news articles are being posted, and that's their leverage to be able to go and say, this is what students are asking for. We need this sort of support. So how do we get more of that? We need more of that. Like, we need more of these sort of conversations getting posted, getting publicized, getting reshared to be get that sort of support, right? And our ministry can only do what we ask of them. And if we're not asking loud enough, we're not going to get it. It's kind of like the squeaky wheel.
It's what I was studying my all my public policy classes as well. Policy analysts, they only recommend actions if people are loud enough to call the attention of the policy analysts. So if there are not enough people asking for that, probably the recommendation will be just continue what you're doing. You have more important things to do. And
Absolutely. That is the reality right now.
yeah. Well, trying to shift a little bit the conversation for just the provincial responsibility, or talking about the PNP, right? I forgot what it stands for, but the general post-secondary education, trying to attract more workers. Is this a strategy that makes sense if the education by itself is underfunded? Because we both, like, you've talked a little bit before, right? It's not something that makes sense directly. And yeah, how does it, like, they say we need more construction workers, nurse and tech grads, but we also don't have a direct cap. We put a cap on international students and we limit the growing of the workforce naturally. How do you say about that? Sorry for the long question.
PNP is the provincial nominee program. Immigration is a federal mandate, so like it's not much in the hand of province. What we can do is advocate with the province to get more seats for the provincial nominee program. And from what I understand, the province has been advocating to the feds to be able to get that. So it's immigration. So the way it works is, if you have a PNP, you have a sure shot of getting a PR, because the points just are that much higher. So if you go express entry, it's very difficult as an international student to meet the requirements to be able to get that. And I think that's where we are. Like there's a lot of qualified people. Who gets to stay in, is going to be a difficult conversation, and we're just raising the bar more and more and more. So that's where we are right now. It's not sustainable. I see why we need to lower it, but I'm an international student. I am in the point where, like, I was told if I study in a priority occupation, I will be able to get a PR because I am. So in my profession in accounting, there's supposed to be a 10,000 people gap in vacancy because people are retiring. Like Canada has an old age problem. Immigrants are the reason why the average age is lower, because we're getting these productive people. And they're saying, okay, accounting, we have to like train them with Canadian CPA standards. They have to have this level of rigor. It's a very strenuous program. Like people don't look to do accounting, right? So if somebody's that done it, with the goal that this is a program where there's a need, so my job is guaranteed. But my ability to continue doing that job with the PR eventually, there's no guarantee for it, because it's no longer the PNP is no longer being offered to people in priority occupations. It's the highest priority, right? So this makes it harder for people to say, okay, I'm not in healthcare, I'm not in early childcare, I'm not in construction. Is BC the place I want to be? And that means every other industry suffers. Right. So do you really, is that the way you want to go? Like, are we taking the short-term focus and ignoring the long-term impacts of our actions? And I think that's the conversation we need to be remembering. Like, we always need to be thinking long-term what our goals are. And we cannot just be pigeonholed into this myopic vision of what our PNP program is meant to be doing.
Well, thank you so much. I think those were all the questions trying to cover a little bit of the subject, Joel. Do you have any final messages that you want to pass along to the community of Burnaby, how to organize themselves?
You cannot change the world, but you can start changing your community. Have these conversations at the dinner table, at bus stops. Like, start talking about it in public. When you see all of these polls that come out, Angus Reid polls say for a change, they're listening to the conversations that are happening on the roadside. So the more conversations you have, the more it gets into the collective mindset. So you have to start making noise. And noise doesn't just happen from media. Media picks up whatever people are talking about on the dinner table. So make post-secondary your dinner table conversation in every conversation, and eventually we'll get something fixed.